This is Lionel Corbett, A Depth Psychological Approach to the Sacred, September 15th, 2008.
I'm always terrified of introductions like that because I'm never sure I can live up to them. So, you can't hear me? Oh, hell. It started already. Well, I'll do the best I can. I'm not very good at projecting. I've been trying not to do it for a long time. I want to say something about the new book. The new book is just my attempt to explain what I really meant in the first book. So, what the new book is about is what I see going on around me, which I think is an emerging new form of spirituality. And it's arising mostly out of the tradition of depth psychology. How's this? Can you hear me? It's difficult. Well, I don't know if I can get any nearer. Okay. All right. I'm going to talk about an emerging spiritual practice that's arising from the tradition of depth psychology. It's arising in consulting rooms and in small groups like this all over the country. Are you hearing me at the back at all? Somewhat. It's useful for two groups of people. It's useful for people who have an interest in who are committed to a traditional religion, and it's useful also for people who have a personal sense of the sacred, but who are not related to, who can't really find a home in any of the established traditions. It's particularly important in that group, a group of people who have a powerful sense of the sacred individually, but find that they're somewhat turned off by the traditional religions. I won't bore you with all the reasons that people are disillusioned with the traditions, because I'm sure that everyone here is familiar with all that. One of the major reasons that we're disillusioned with the traditions is that the way the traditions have told us that the sacred manifests itself may not be the way we actually experience the sacred in practice. Some time ago, a friend of mine called me up and said that he'd had a dream in which a voice said to him, God dooms us to live a life apart from him. And he called me up and he said, how can that possibly be? He's been committed to the church for a long time. And he said, what could this dream possibly mean? And I was reminded of Meister Eckhart's comment when he said, God save me from God. Meaning that if you have a traditional preconceived idea of the way the sacred should manifest itself, then when you actually have an experience of the sacred, you may not realize what you're experiencing. It may not live up to your actual expectations. So the traditions that have told us the way in which the sacred is, as it were, supposed to appear through the sacraments of the church or the commandments of the Torah or whichever tradition you happen to belong to. But in fact, what we're finding nowadays is that people experience the sacred in all kinds of ways, apart from those traditional ways. They experience the sacred in dreams, in visionary experience, in relationships, in creative work, in the natural world, in the body. The body is making something of a comeback. In synchronistic events and a variety of other ways. I'll try and cover several of them this evening. I may not cover all of them. So I want to talk tonight about the way the sacred actually manifests itself rather than the way they told you it should do in Sunday school. And I find that they're not the same thing. So I want to talk about first of all, some criteria. Well, if I'm going to make this claim that the sacred can manifest itself in ways outside the traditional ways that we've been told to expect it, how do we know that this is a manifestation of the sacred? What criteria do we use? And here I'm going to borrow from Jung, who borrowed from Otto. So this is my fantasy about Jung's fantasy about Otto's fantasy. So, you know. But this is what I think is happening here. In the 30s, I think about 1937, Jung gave the Terry lectures on the psychology of religion at Yale. And he'd recently read the work of Otto, and the book is called The Idea of the Holy. In German, it's simply called Das Heilige. It was translated as The Idea of the Holy because I think the people thought he was a Kantian, so it had to be just The Idea of the Holy, not the Holy itself, whatever that is. And what Otto was trying to do was get at the essence of religious experience. He felt that there'd been too much emphasis on formal worship services and those kind of spiritual practices, morality and so on, and the people had lost touch with the essence of religion, which had to do with personal experience of the sacred. Otto tried to articulate the essence of sacred experience. And he used the term numinous to describe this. And what I'd like to do is give you an example of several types of numinous experience. He said that a numinous experience is mysterious, tremendous, and fascinating. Examples, obvious biblical examples, would be something like Moses at the burning bush. Moses is tending his father-in-law's sheep, and he sees the bush which is not consumed by the fire, and a voice speaks to him out of the bush and says, "Come over here, I have a job for you." Or Saul on the road to Damascus on his way to persecute Jesus' followers. Here's a voice saying, "Why do you persecute me?" and sees a blinding light, thrown off his horse, he's blind for 3 days. That's what Otto is talking about when he talked about numinous experiences. And obviously those experiences are mysterious, tremendous, fascinating, and so on. So those were the criteria that Otto used. And he said that it's an experience of otherness. It's an experience of something that's obviously not ordinary, that not from this realm. Something that seems to be way out of our ordinary everyday experience, that we can't explain. It's a total mystery. It's completely fascinating. And it's awe-inspiring, A-W-E, awe. It produces a kind of dread, a kind of holy fear, not the kind of fear that you have if you've just had a narrow escape on the freeway, but more the kind of dread that when you it's more like something that's uncanny, like seeing a ghost. It's that kind of awe is what Otto was talking about. Sometimes you have one of these experiences and you feel blessed or cleansed in some way. Usually there are experiences that make us feel very humble, small, what Otto called the creature feeling. When you have one of these experiences, you realize that you're in relation to something much larger than yourself. So those are the two great biblical examples. But it turns out that these examples are not confined to just to the founders of the tradition, not just to Moses or Jesus or to Muhammad taking dictation from the angel Gabriel. I mean, these kinds of experiences, these kinds of numinous experiences, happen to ordinary people all the time. And they're very important because they can have a very healing effect. In fact, in about 1945, Jung wrote in a letter that he thought that the essence of what he thought the essence of his method of psychotherapy was contact with the numinous. He thought that was the real healing factor. That's in a way Jung's theory of cure, that you're really cured because of essence, because of connection with that essence, connection with the transcendent realm, with the transpersonal realm. Now, the Jungians think of this in terms of connection, of relationship to the transpersonal level of consciousness. And I don't know, most people in this group, I don't know whether people are familiar with Jung's notion of the objective psyche or the autonomous psyche. Can I just assume that everyone knows that and skip that? Thank God for that. Okay. Anyway, there's a dimension of consciousness beyond the personal, which Jung originally referred to as the collective unconscious. We now tend to talk about it as the objective psyche or the autonomous psyche. And most of us feel that when you have one of these experiences, it's essentially like the mind of God, or what in Zen would be called big mind, or something like that. Some transcendent level of consciousness beyond the personal. And that when you have a numinous experience, somehow your own individual consciousness is in relation to that larger consciousness that normally we don't experience very often. So what I'd like to do is give you some examples of that. Maybe I should, in the interest of full disclosure, tell you how I became interested in this myself, because the point, a big point that I'm going to make is that these experiences may not take a Judeo-Christian form. They may take a Judeo-Christian form. I mean, people still have visions of Jesus or the Virgin Mary on a somewhat regular basis, although, as I'll talk to you about, people are often reluctant to describe those kind of experiences, because they're afraid that if they say they've had a vision like that, the people will think that they're crazy. But very often the experience is quite novel, and it really doesn't fit into the traditional ways of thinking about the divine. So what I'll do is talk about some unusual sort of non-Judeo-Christian forms of numinous experience. Because when you have one of these experiences yourself, you have a private, a personal experience of the sacred. Now, the way I got interested in this was that many years ago, I was going through a period of turmoil in my life, and usually these experiences will occur during periods of turmoil. There doesn't seem to be a lot of need for an experience of the sacred when things are going well. So they're most helpful when one is in turmoil. Anyway, so I happened to look up through the window, looked up into the sky, and as I looked up in the sky, I saw a large face in the sky looking down at me. Now that's a very numinous experience. It was very powerful. At the time, I was running an inpatient psychiatric unit, and I was hearing these stories all day. So it was also somewhat alarming to have the experience myself. And if we have time, later on I can talk about the difference between these kind of experiences and psychosis. They're really not the same, although there is some overlap, but we can get back to that. I didn't know quite what to make of this experience. It was quite brief. In fact, let me just tell you what William James, when he writes about this, he says that these characteristics have... There are four characteristics of these kind of experiences. This is William James. First of all, they're ineffable. It's very difficult to describe them in ordinary conceptual language. And unless you've had an experience like this, it's difficult to convey the quality of the experience. What Otto is really trying to do is convey a certain emotional quality that makes them different than ordinary experiences. Secondly, they have a noetic or cognitive aspect. They give you some information that you didn't know before. They produce a kind of sense of understanding or clarity. You get something that you didn't get before. And I'll give you some of these instances which are like teaching examples. And the experience, by the way, is what I call self-authenticating. In other words, if you have a burning bush or a road to Damascus kind of experience, you don't usually argue with it. And if people tell you it didn't happen, you know that it did happen. So that's what I mean by self. You don't need anyone to tell you that it's real, okay? Because the experience has a tremendous sense of authority about it. And then it's transient. Usually it's quite brief. Rarely lasts more than half an hour, although there are occasions where it can go on for a few days, but that's quite rare. James's fourth point is that during the experience, one feels very passive. One's own will is in abeyance. There's nothing you can do to make it come or go. Those are James's criteria. Anyway, I had this experience. I didn't know what to make of it. And then I had, a little while after that, a dream of a very large UFO. This was a dream, not a waking experience. And it was a huge thing, enormously large, and it started to descend, got closer and closer, and finally hovered a short distance above my head, which was numinous in its own right because it was so big. And then light shone down, rather like this, actually. And searchlights from the base of this thing. And when I looked up, the light was coming out of eyes. What would be normally the lens of the light or the bulb was actually eyes, and the base of this thing was studded with eyes, and the light was coming out of these eyes on me. So obviously the waking vision of the face looking at me and this dream experience of being looked at by these eyes had this common theme of being looked at from above. Now, a UFO is obviously not a Judeo-Christian manifestation of the sacred. But if Otto is correct, if Otto's criteria are worthwhile, and I should say that not everyone agrees with Otto. People have other ways of thinking about what the nature of authentic religious experiences, but that's an academic discussion. But if for a moment you'll accept Otto's criteria that it's an experience of the sacred, if it's mysterious, tremendous, and fascinating, and awe-inspiring, and dreadful, and so on, then this would qualify as a numinous experience. It obviously was an experience, both of them together, of something other. You probably know Jung's essay in volume 10 on flying saucers, that he thought were experiences of the transpersonal self because they're mandala-shaped. Can I skip over what all that's about and just assume that everyone knows what I'm talking about? So, the imagery is of being seen by something from another realm. That's what Otto is talking about, being in touch or related to something from another realm, not from this earth, from somewhere else. And that's the experience of the numinous, that there's a transcendent dimension, and for a moment, somehow the veil is lifted and we're in touch with that. We have an experience of that. Now, I've heard a lot of these experiences in therapy, and I've brought a collection of them. And what I'm interested in is what is the relationship of the way the numinous manifests itself and the individual psychology of the experiencer? Why did Moses experience it as in the form of fire, for example, and not in some other form? I mean, fire is a very ancient manifestation of the sacred. In many traditions, the tongues of flame at Pentecost descending on the disciples of Jesus and so on. There are all kinds of ways in which the sacred manifests itself as fire. The Bible's full of it. But it appears in other ways as well. So why fire and why not some, like Job experienced it as a whirlwind, for example. So I'm interested, I would say to Moses, if he was here, what does fire mean to you? Why do you get it particularly in the form of fire? What is the relationship of the way it appears and one's character structure? So I thought to myself, well, why would I get it in the form of these, of being seen in this way? And of course the answer is a personal complex of mine which has to do with growing up feeling not seen and suffering from. I don't know if that's happened to anybody else here, but I was greatly helped by a Vedic astrologer who said to me, I know the problem. The problem is your soul doesn't come from around here. That was a big relief to me. But I did grow up with a like many people, with a sense of being an alien and not really belonging and wondering what the heck I was doing here and why these strange people were doing what they... I still think that, actually, when I read the papers. But you may know that sense of not belonging and of... not really being seen for who one is. Of course, it was a family problem. I remember after I'd been in practice about 20 years, going home to visit my parents and my mother saying to me, now, what is it you do? So it's that kind of thing about not being seen. Okay. So this is obviously a complex that I'm obviously revealing itself now. And these experiences, you see, were both about being seen. And that's, I think, what Jung talks about when he says that the archetype, sort of contact with the archetypal realm brings what's needed. That's how it has a healing effect. It often, and I give you some examples, it often addresses a complex, an area of emotional difficulty in the personality, and it speaks to it in some way, or sometimes it speaks to a developmental need of the moment or a crisis that we're in and so on. So let me give you some more examples of this. And I've got a mixture of dreams and visions. I want to spend rather a long time on visions, if you don't mind, because visions have a bad reputation. Many people are afraid of having visions, but they're actually somewhat common. People will only talk about them very privately, as I said before, because we're afraid of being thought to be crazy. Or sometimes people are afraid of envy as well. Well, this is a numinous dream of a friend of mine who's a Franciscan priest, who's been in the priesthood for, I think, 30 years or so. And he's sort of been okay with it, but not quite. And he was never quite sure exactly what was not quite right about it. And he had the following dream. The dream begins, and he says in the dream, "I am Melchizedek." The biblical scholars here will know that Melchizedek is a priest who shows up somewhere in Genesis. I forget the reference. Genesis 14, verses 18 to 20. And he blesses Abraham. And the problem is that no one really knows where he comes from. What is his provenance? Who ordained him? What's his lineage? And so we have this concept that theologians talk about, the Melchizedek priest. It seems to be, the archetype seems to be somebody who's a priest by divine ordination. Not simply, in other words, this man at a very deep soul level is a priest, archetypally. You know, archetypally, some people are priests, some are teachers, some are healers, some are students. So people have a very deep archetypal imprints on the soul about the kind of vocation that they have. So this man clearly has a very profound priestly vocation. I think that's why the dream opens up by him knowing that he's Melchizedek. Anyway, that's just an aside. The dream says, "I'm Melchizedek." And then a radiant blue image of the goddess of Willendorf looms over me. The goddess is much larger than I am, perhaps three times larger. I'm holding this, which contains the philosopher's stone, up to the breast of the goddess. Milk is flowing from her left breast into the chalice. I'm deeply aware that I'm in the presence of something intensely holy. This is not your average Franciscan priest's dream, okay? He's got this very ancient goddess image. Those of you who know Maria Gimbutas's work will be familiar with this. These are ancient goddess images from old Europe. I don't know the date, 15, 20,000 years ago, something like that. And she's hovering above him. Milk is coming from her breast, and he's holding a communion cup and catching the milk in this cup. So the dream is saying that that what is sacramental is the milk of the goddess or the divine feminine. Okay. Obviously, the difficulty has been that for him, the church's official container hasn't paid enough attention to the divine feminine, which is really what is sacred to him. Now, one of the values of this approach is that it gives you a personal spirituality. Let's say you're a committed Christian, then your symbol of connection to the sacred might be the cross. But there'd be millions of people who relate to the sacred by means of the cross. But when you have a numinous experience like this, you're given an individual symbol that may not be relevant to anybody else. That's the value of this approach, and that in a sense is the crux of what I want to talk about. If this man was to develop a personal altar, he would have to have a Venus of Willendorf image on it. But that may not have any meaning to anybody else. So the point about this approach is that it gives you individual, a symbol is a bridge, a connection to the realm of the sacred. It's a linking image. So this is his symbol, and it's totally individual, totally personal. let me give you some more. Let me give you a visionary experience to illustrate just how healing these can be. This is a man who's going through a period of despair and turmoil, and he had the following waking vision. A vision is somewhat like a dream, except you're awake. Okay? I was seeing as if my eyes had turned backwards, and I was looking at something taking place within me. So this is an inner vision. Sometimes it's an inner vision, and sometimes it's an outer vision, but the experience is the same. I was lifted up and stood on a high mountain peak with large rock outcroppings. I couldn't see over the edge. Surrounding me, sitting among the rocks, were the shadowy forms of the hosts of heaven. I knew they had gathered there in order to meet me. They seemed to be expecting me and to delight in my presence. A soft white glow radiated around me, and I felt a deep warmth and sense of belonging. For that moment in time, I was heaven's agenda. Now, what do you do if you're a therapist and someone walks in with that kind of experience? You can either say, what were you smoking? Or did somebody slip you something in a drink? Or you can take the thing at face value as an experience of connection with transcendent level of reality or the transpersonal psyche, okay? And a lot depends on one's own sort of metaphysical commitments, which attitude one takes. Very often you'll find that they're related. In the therapeutic, I was just stopping because I was realizing that most of the examples that I've got here come from my own psychotherapy practice. And that obviously is, I was just realizing, is a very highly selected group of people who are going through some kind of emotional difficulty. But I don't want to give the impression, which I was afraid I was about to, that these things are confined to people with emotional disturbances. They're not. It just so happens that those are the people that I mostly talk to, but I'm quite sure that these things happen to people all the time, who not necessarily people who are going through emotional difficulties. Nevertheless, they do depict the archetypal core of people's emotional difficulties. And what they do very often that's helpful is they give you an image of the archetype at the center of the complex that's causing the mischief. Is everyone familiar with the notion of the archetype? I don't need to go through that. That's a big relief too. Okay. So here's the dream of a complex. Well, I'll give you a couple. One is a woman dreams that she's in a small canoe drifting down a dark river at night. It's pitch black. And she sees light on the water ahead of her. And when she gets to the light, she sees that the light is emanating from a huge figure, which is standing with one foot on either side of the river. It's gigantic, like several stories high. It's a female figure with many breasts. And the light is emanating and shining down on from this figure onto the water. As the boat, the little canoe, gets under the legs of this figure into the light, the dreamer falls off the boat and drowns. Now, the dream is related to the Great Mother, the archetype of the Great Mother. One can see that very clearly. This is not a human figure. It's clearly a goddess image. It's clearly the archetypal feminine. And it relates to this woman's mother complex. The difficulty that she had was that her mother was so powerful that when she would get in her mother's light or her mother's orbit or her mother's sort of atmosphere, she would go completely unconscious. And what the dream does is it gives an image of that, gives an image of the difficulty. And somehow seeing it like that can be quite helpful because you see the power of it. And you get to realize what you've been struggling with for a long time. Here's another one. I'm in a maze of stairs, doors, and ramps, like an Escher drawing. I'm running from the giant severed head of my mother. Streaming from her are tentacles that move like snakes and allow her to chase me. I perceive her as a monster. Forgive me, I have to interrupt the dream narration to say that another major difference, this started off as a piece of roast beef, but it's rapidly turning into hash, so I'm sorry, it's just going to come out this way. Another major difference between this approach and the traditional approaches is that the traditional approaches tend to think of the sacred as always helpful, always loving, always healing. But in psychological experience, the sacred has a terrifying aspect to it. It's not experienced as only love or only light. You know how in the Hebrew Bible, at least, the divine, it's acknowledged, can have a terrifying aspect to it. Amos says, unless the Lord wills it, if something about evil befalls a city if the Lord wills it. Isaiah says, I create evil and I make suffering. I forget the exact quotes. It's well known in the Hebrew Bible. In the New Testament, there's more of a tendency, like I think it's in second letter of John or somewhere, where he says, he's only light and in him there is no darkness. The divine seems to get more and more purified of darkness as we go along in the Bible. But in actual experience, the numinous experience can actually have a very terrifying aspect. It doesn't always have a loving, benevolent aspect, even though it may be benevolent in its intention. But as we experience, that's why Jung wrote about what he called the dark side of the self. The self here has a capital S, the transpersonal self. And that's what got him in big trouble with the theologians, because they didn't like the notion that the self could have a dark side to it, the self being our image of the divine. And then there's a big argument about what's the relationship between the image that we have and the divine itself, and are they different, and so on. And if you're philosophically inclined, that can keep you awake at night. And Jung says, I don't know what the relationship is, I just know there's some kind of relationship between the image that we have of the divine, or the way we experience it, and the divine itself. Anyway, I'm just making a long-winded point that sometimes numinous experience takes a very painful, unpleasant aspect. So the dream goes on. She's streaming from her head are tentacles that move like snakes and allow her to chase me. I perceive her as a monster. I'm afraid of her and disgusted by her and don't want her to touch me. She's laughing. I there's no point in my running away from her. There's no way I can ever escape. She occasionally catches up with me and touches me with a tentacle. And it goes on and on like that. It ends up with the dreamer crying in terror and frustration. So this is the numinosum, the archetype, in the form of the Gorgon or the Medusa, with the head with streaming snakes. The head that, you know, in myth turned people to stone. So that obviously was the quality of this woman's personal mother. And here it is depicted as an archetypal image showing her the whole problem in a very numinous form, but in a very painfully negative form. But if Otto's criteria are correct, it is mysterious, fascinating, and tremendous. There's no getting around the fact that these even very negative dreams can be very, very numinous. I've got several other examples. I don't want to get too gruesome. Here's one more. Oh, I've got lots more, actually, but I don't know which one to... well, actually, I've got a better one. Let me just... this is the dream of... this dream illustrates the point that the way the traditions tell you that the sacred is manifest is not the way the sacred actually may appear to you. Now, I'll tell you this dream, and the punchline is at the end. Okay, this is the dream of a woman physician just about to start her psychiatric residency. That's the setting. I enter the room of a woman patient. She's lying on the floor in the fetal position. She's weak, emaciated, and her body is covered with bruises where she's been beaten. She's been severely abused. She's also dangerous and combative. I lift her frail body and listen to her heart. There's terror on her face. She's like a vicious animal. She may attack me at any time. She eventually allows the examination and so on. And the end of the dream says, I come away with the awareness that she is very ill and she will be my first psychiatric patient. Her name is Mary, and I realize that she is, in fact, the Blessed Virgin Mary. Now, this is not a sort of traditional holy card appearance of the Blessed Virgin Mary. She's normally wearing a nice blue outfit, standing on the moon, you know. And she's not emaciated, beaten out of her head and abused. But the point is that the dreamer is quite convinced this is the Blessed Virgin Mary. Illustrating this discrepancy between what we've been told and the way the archetype actually manifests itself in people's lives. Now, at the personal level, the feminine in this woman's family and in her psyche had been beaten and abused and so on. I mean, that's the obvious personal level. At the collective level, the sacred feminine has also been beaten and abused. We're all familiar with how. With what, so this is a dream which carries personal material and cultural and historical material about the abuse of the feminine and so on. There's a tremendous amount packed into this dream for the individual woman and the culture. Because we all, in our own pathology, carry some of the burden of the culture, don't we? So the important point is that there's a redemptive quality in the dream. The dream tells her that her work on her own difficulty will help in the redemption of the larger cultural problem, which is crucially important. And a very important aspect of the depth psychological approach, that the individual work that we do on our own difficulty will have a redemptive effect on the culture at large. I hope that's true. It's hard when you look around to know if that's true, but maybe it's true. Yes.
Dreams come and go. I mean,
they do, don't they? Yes.
But unless you make that dream conscious,
yes,
that will bring about a redemptive. But if it's just a dream,
if you don't work on it, yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. Maybe nothing would happen. That's quite right. That's why Jung stresses over and over again that it's very important for us all to do our own small piece of work, because it does help with the larger problem. Let me give you one more, because in the Christian tradition, the Divine Feminine is manifest as the Blessed Virgin Mary. In the Jewish tradition, it's manifest as the Shekhinah, or the Divine Presence of God, or Sophia, perhaps. Those would be the two manifestations in the Jewish tradition. But in people's lives, it can manifest itself in a variety of ways, and sometimes the way it manifests itself is found in other mythologies, not just the Judeo-Christian mythology. In other words, as somebody said, you can't Christianize the unconscious. The unconscious will appear, and it will borrow from any mythological system the world over. Okay? So even though you were born in this culture and raised in a particular tradition, you can have archetypal imagery in your dreams that could come from any mythological tradition. Because by virtue of being human, we all participate in that human heritage. That's why the Jungians are fond of saying that you can locate the transpersonal in your own material, and you can locate your own material in the transpersonal. That's the value of studying myth. Anyway, the proof of that is this kind of dream of a young man who, needless to say, as you'll hear, has difficulty with women. I'm tied to a stake at the base of a high gilded throne. On the throne is a huge woman with large teeth. Blood is flowing like a river down the steps in front of her. Pardon me. I cannot talk. My energy is being drained by another woman who's sucking blood from my neck and arm. I'm helpless and terrified and too weak to do anything. Now, this is a Kali-like image, K-A-L-I. Kali is a goddess from the Hindu pantheon. This is an image of the Great Mother in what Neumann would call her terrible aspect. It's a vampire image. And that tells you a lot about the energy draining quality of his personal mother. But it also shows you that you can't see the archetypal quality of this material unless you have some grasp of world mythology. And you can't expect that the unconscious will only produce material from your own tradition. It may not. Oh, excuse me. I'm not used to shouting at this volume. Are you hearing me okay at the back? Okay. This is why Jung said that the experience of the archetype, and numinous, for the Jungians, numinous experiences are experience of the archetypal realm. He says they strike at the core of one's being. And this is the kind of reason that he says that. It's not all misery. Sometimes these numinous experiences are very helpful. And I'd like to tell you some of the helpful ones. This is the story of a woman who lost her 21-year-old son in a drowning accident, totally unexpectedly. And it was obviously very devastating, and it almost destroyed this woman. She was very full of pain and anguish and so on. She was a deeply religious woman, but she could get no comfort from her tradition. There just seemed to be no answer that was helpful to her. And she would pray a great deal about where her son was, as it were, what was happening. And she had the following dream. And the extraordinary thing about this, she said, I knew I was dreaming, but I felt as though I was awake. And I hear that occasionally. I'm not sure what it means, but I think it must have some meaning. I don't know quite what it is. Anyway, here's the dream. There was a magnificent panoramic view, a soft twilight glow in the atmosphere. There were hundreds of people of all ages in small groups. I searched through the crowd but couldn't find him. I called out to him, "Michael, Michael, where are you?" Suddenly, out of nowhere, came a 3-year-old child on a tricycle, laughing out loud and riding in and out of the crowd. As he came nearer, I saw that he was Michael as he was during his childhood. My fear quickly turned to joy. Now, as a result of this dream, much of her distress was improved. It was actually improved a great deal. She felt quite sure that this was a message to her, that life continues on another plane of existence. And, of course, this is not the kind of dream that needs any analysis. It sort of speaks for itself. That's what James means when he says that these things are self-authenticating. Who's going to argue with her? Now, one could argue with a dream like this. One could say, well, if I was, let's say I was a reductive, materialistic, atheistic psychoanalyst, okay? I know I wouldn't be here if I was, but let's say I was. I could very easily say, well, clearly, this woman's in great distress, and as a defense mechanism to alleviate her distress, the unconscious comes up with this scenario, which is just a kind of a self-soothing device. It's essentially a defensive operation. So that would be a sort of a psychoanalytic reduction. There are many ways, there are many forms of reduction. Biological reduction. If one has a visionary experience, the biological reduction would be you took a drug, or you hadn't slept for a few days, or your brain is not working properly. There are all kinds of ways that these experiences can be reduced. And so it's a matter of your own belief, whether you take them at face value, sui generis, or whether you think there's some other cause for it. The question for the practitioner is, are you colluding? If it's a defense against unbearable pain, and you go along with it and take it at face value, are you colluding with the experience? And do you need to maintain a kind of artificial professional persona, you know, a neutral position? Or can you just go along with it? And I think that's just, I think you just have to fall back on your own human response to the situation and how it feels to you. All right, so here's some more visionary experiences. This is the experience of a senior nursing administrator who had just resigned from the hospital that she worked at because of what she called compassion fatigue. I think we'd probably call it burnout. All her life she'd been a caretaker and was very identified with professional success. Now, those of us in the helping professions know that most people in the helping professions give what they need. Most of us trained to be helpers as small children, you know. And we just get a few diplomas to hang on the wall to make it official, as we, you know. But most of us are good at helping because we were helpers as children. So she'd been a caretaker all her life, and she felt that she couldn't meet her own standards. She felt that the various changes in healthcare and the administration in the hospital and so on had made it for her to live up to her own standards of how things should be done. So she was lying in bed one night, ruminating about her career and her life and what to do and so on. She had this experience. These are her words. "Suddenly I was aware of a pinpoint of light at the foot of the bed. I became alarmed. It expanded in size to about a 6-inch oval, floating mysteriously in the dark. I was fearful and fascinated. There's Otto's criteria. Awestruck by the weird presence of something other than me in my bedroom, I was sure I was not dreaming. The oval of light spoke wordlessly and identified itself as the compassionate heart. One can't say if it's Jesus or Buddha, but it's the compassionate heart. A loving presence filled the room and flooded me. The oval of light shot a beam of light directly into my heart. At that moment, I saw myself with divinely compassionate eyes, and I was filled with a sense of forgiveness, unconditional love, and complete self-acceptance. Does this sound defensive to you? I didn't need to do anything, the silent voice instructed. I just needed to be as I was in this love-filled moment. That's tremendously important for those people who feel that they always have to be doing in order to justify their existence. I didn't need to do anything. My heart felt so expanded that I began to experience chest pain. I thought of calling for help, but I was paralyzed. This is Otto's notion of dread, holy terror. After this moment of terror, I experienced such peace that I thought I'd died. In that moment of surrender, again, that's James's notion of the passivity of the will. I mean, these guys seem to know what they were talking about. I saw the most loving moments of my life and the ones when I had constricted the impulse of love. I saw the moments when I had judged myself as lovable only because I had tried to live from a conscious standard of love and service. So this visionary experience, it was a waking experience, initiated a period of self-discovery. And she discovered her judgmental superego and the need to care for others instead of herself and so on. And what it ended up doing was opening up an authentic capacity to love, which was not based on a professional persona. It's as if she had to experience it in order to really be able to give it. And now she's in the ministry. She left nursing. I mean, still helping, but she's in the ministry. Okay. Now, this is another visionary experience of a woman who had also been severely abused in childhood, had great difficulty making connections to people. She says relationship remained the most elusive and difficult aspect of my life. So this is a waking vision. She's lying in bed, and a figure appeared dressed in a long, heavy, dark brown hooded robe and stood on my pelvis facing me. I felt her presence and saw her clearly, although she was silent and weightless as she stood on my body. Okay, so she's lying in bed, this figure appears and stands on her pelvis, but there's no weight. So you have to wonder, as it were, where this is happening. If where is not a meaningful term here. But my heart pounded and I was unable to move, but I didn't feel afraid. I sensed her deep caring and her intention to help me. She leaned forward, and with her finger, she touched the place between my breasts adjacent to my heart. As she did so, she drew up her finger and began to withdraw a heavy, rough cord from around my heart. I felt the sensation of it unbinding my heart, and I felt ease and relief as the rope was drawn away. For many minutes, the heavy cord diminished in size, becoming finer and finer, finally emerging as a very thin silver-white gossamer thread. Now, as she withdrew the fiber, she was using it to weave a cloth that fell to the floor. And this cloth covered a large dark puddle that was around me. This experience, it permeated me so deeply, I was profoundly touched, shaken, and moved. So I think you'll agree that that meets Otto's criteria. It's mysterious, fascinating, tremendous. And of course, you could easily reduce it. It could easily be reduced. I talked some years ago to Guy Corneau, who's a French-Canadian Jungian analyst. And he told me of an experience rather like this when he was very ill, and a figure, he was perhaps on the point of death, and a figure appeared in his room and did something in his body. And it's actually, I can talk about it because it's published. It's published in French, in a French volume called Raison d'être, but it is a public document now. And this figure did something in his body, and he got better. And he told me, we were having lunch, and he told me, he said, I made the mistake of talking about it at an APA meeting. And everybody insisted that he must have been, you know, toxic in a delirium, or it was the drugs or something, because people can't tolerate the fact, you know, because this kind of stuff is very difficult to fit into our contemporary way of thinking about the psyche. You know, especially if you're a cognitive behavioral therapist, this is not the kind of thing you like to hear. Anyway, so to go back to this experience, what's happened is the figure unbinds her heart. That's the metaphor of the her heart has been constricted, so she can't love, and the figure unbinds her heart. It's like that fairy tale of the iron bands around the heart. I can't remember the title of it, but I asked her about the weaving of the cloth, and she associated it to Clotho. Clotho was a figure from Greek mythology, one of the three fates. There were three fates who were like divine beings who determined the course of your life. One of them spun the thread, one of them wove it into the particular pattern or tapestry of your life, and then at the end, one cut the thread when your life was over. And no one could resist the fates, of course. They're very important in the story of Oedipus. So, this was Clotho, who was the weaver, the one who does the weaving. And the dark pool around her is like this woman's chronic depression. And so there's a sort of a new chapter being woven for her that enables her to cross it and so on. The metaphor is kind of obvious. What's interesting is where, if one can use the word, you see, I don't like to say where is this happening. If there's no weight, if this figure is standing on her but she feels no weight, it can't be happening in ordinary physical reality, because then there would be weight. So where is it happening? It must be happening in what Corbin calls the mundus imaginalis, the imaginal realm, the realm of the subtle body, an intermediate realm between the material realm and the realm of pure spirit. I'm talking nonsense, okay? Because these things are not spatial. See, I mean, the very term depth psychology is a misleading term, because it makes it sound as if the unconscious, or this, the unconscious is somehow down, and if you want to experience the unconscious, you have to go down. But that's absurd if you think about it, because the unconscious is right here in the room. It's not. You don't have to rip up the floor to get to the unconscious. It's in the room at the moment, right here. So the term depth psychology and these spatial metaphors about consciousness don't work very well. And I don't know quite what to replace them with. We're kind of stuck with the term, but it is a somewhat misleading term. Anyway, Corbin, this is the realm that, you remember, Jung thought was the realm that the alchemists were experiencing. When the alchemists were doing their stuff in their lab, and they were experiencing having all these visionary experiences, he says that they're in this realm of the imaginatio. Imaginatio is the Latin word for imagination, without the N at the end. We don't use the word imagination, because in English it tends to mean something that's not real. So what Corbin, Jung, and so on want to convey is the notion that the imaginatio is real. It's the psyche is real. It's a real domain. And that these experiences, wherever they're occurring, are real experiences. These perceptions of that realm are, as James says, they're noetic. They have a cognitive importance. They impart information, which he says, and I agree, is as important as the information that you get from the five senses and from the intellect. When you have one of these experiences, they give you valid information. They're not imagination in the sense of not real. Okay. Sometimes people have I don't want to encroach on eternity, and I can't remember what time I started. So, does anyone know how long? Can I keep going for a bit, or?
Can you keep going? Maybe, yes. And take a short break. Maybe.
Should I go on a few more minutes or stop?
Just take a short break. And
okay. I just want to give a few what I call teaching examples, because these things can have very profound teaching effects. And sometimes they can be traditional. This, by the way, is not an approach that somehow says the traditions are wrong. If your experience of the sacred is authentically Christian, for example, then that's where you belong. It's just that if you experience it in some other way, you might not belong there. Well, some people do belong in the Christian tradition, obviously. Here's such an experience. This is a man, and I think this experience furthers his spirituality. He says, I woke up, again, it's a waking experience, with a sense, an overwhelming sense of a presence in the house. There was a vacuous, eerie silence. I sat up in bed, and a very quiet, rumbling tone began. A tiny white light appeared. By the way, light is one of the most ancient manifestations of the sacred. You find it in all traditions, going back at least to the Assyrians. Anyway, as the volume of the tone increased, so did the size of the light, becoming a ball that increased in circumference. The tone grew so loud I could hardly tolerate it. By this time, the globe of light was 5 feet in diameter and so bright I could hardly look at it. On the light, on the ball of light, appeared a symbol I didn't understand. That's also a fairly common motif, the unknown symbol. From the center of the light, I heard a voice say, Jesus, and the ball of light moved towards me, striking me with a gentle force. Everything disappeared and the room became quiet and dark. A second later, another tone and dot of light appeared that also grew, and on this was a different unknown symbol, and this time the voice said, Christ, and the light flew into me. There was another brief moment of dark and silence, and a third tone and dot of light appeared. And this time, when the ball flew into me, it was silent. And finally, the room returned to normal, leaving me awestruck. And I think that the message there is that there is an aspect of the divine that cannot be named or spoken, and that this is a non-conceptual experience of silence with a capital S. Because, you know, in the end, the best thing to do is say nothing, isn't it? I mean, when you've said all this stuff, which is all kind of rubbish, all that's left is silence with a capital S, because the absolute reality cannot be spoken about. And I think that's the message to him. Okay, so I think that's a kind of a teaching example. And I've got some more, but do you want to stop and take a break? Pardon?
Well,
I don't know. I don't know how you want. Another, shall I give it one more? All right, well, let me, I've got several. Oh, I've got a nice Buddhist teaching example. This was told to me by a woman, a middle-aged woman, who's now studying to be a Christian minister in seminary, okay? And she said that it happened to her when she was a child, but she says it's totally fresh in my mind. This is the story. I was walking on a beach with my family on a misty day as a small child. She didn't remember exactly how old she was. I had trailed behind the others and I was running to catch up with them, and suddenly a horrible thing happened. The whole world disappeared. There was a black shining surface that was really a vast immeasurable void. You can hear the Buddhist imagery. Nothingness and a vast nothing above it. The vastness was horrible. It was alive and I could feel it, but it wasn't like a being of any kind. As I opened my mouth to scream, nothing came out and I couldn't make a sound. I looked below my feet and I was standing on nothing. I looked at my mother walking ahead of me with her friends. They were suspended over nothing, but they didn't realize it. They didn't realize that nothing was the only thing there is. I ran to the tent sobbing. My mother, this is what happens to kids when they have these experiences. My mother was angry when I tried to tell her about it and accused me of being silly. This is why children don't tell you what they're experiencing. But I believe that if you did not know about the nothing, you were safe, because then the illusion of all the solidity in the world would keep you from... Well, I'd like to go on with some more teaching examples, because they seem especially powerful to me. this is... another waking vision, and in order to understand it, you have to hear just briefly a dream that happened before the vision. In the dream, the dreamer's had a bereavement, and in the dream, she meets the figure of death. And he is tall and he has a black robe and his face is covered with a long veil. And in the dream, she tries to run away from her and death follows her. And she realizes that she can't run away from him and so on. And she's very haunted by this dream image. And then she has this visionary experience. I awoke to a vision of veiled death standing in the corner of my bedroom. I felt curiously calm and yet driven to know this figure more fully. I approached death to throw back his veil. As I did so, I was met with a blinding white light that receded just enough for me to make out the face that had no features, neither male nor female. Death was a shining white-skinned fetus, unformed and yet formed, awesomely beautiful in unborn potential. I realized that death was life, ever poised between being and non-being. Death bent towards me gently and tenderly laid its cheek against mine, a gesture like a benediction. I was flooded with an overwhelming sensation of bliss and love. My heart and brow seemed to open and teem with an exquisite energy. The experience of being touched by this figure was profound. It had the potential to be any being, all being, or no being. The touch of its skin was the most amazing sensation, moist and malleable and positively teeming with life, as if I could feel its cells dividing and changing beneath the surface. So here's death in the form of a fetus that's extremely alive. Okay, so we talked about the fact that this experience suggests that life and death are inextricably connected in some way, that they're two aspects of a unitary process that can't be divided. And it's a mistake to think of death without life or life without death. So that's, I think, is a very powerful teaching tool. When you have this kind of experience, you don't need to be told not to worry about death. It's like the information is given to you. Again, the noetic quality of the experience is important. And sometimes you can be told something in one of these experiences that you already know cognitively, but you get it so directly that it makes an incredibly powerful impression on you. This is another vision. One night when the moon was dark and my bedroom was inky black, I sensed a presence in the corner of the room. I was afraid. The presence grew and grew and then filled the entire room. I lay in terror with my eyes tightly closed. A voice, deep and gentle, said to me, "Love. The whole thing is love." Slowly the energy ebbed from the room, leaving me in paralyzed terror in the darkness. Now, it's nothing new to be told that the whole thing is love and the importance of love and so on. All the traditions talk about that. But when you get it in this form, in this way, it has this indelible effect. And this is a woman who'd had enormous difficulty with loving and being loved. And so this was why the experience was healing. It had done this woman no good to go to church any number of times and be preached at about love. It has no effect at all. But when you have the experience like this, that's the value of direct experience. It goes right to the core of the individual. That's why one could call this approach to spirituality an experiential approach. It's not a dogmatic or doctrinal approach. Another important aspect of this is the numinosum in nature, in the natural world. And let me give you one or two examples of that. Traditionally, there were many nature mystics. Certainly in Christianity, there were several nature mystics. But nowadays, we don't hear many traditional Christians talking about the sacred nature of the environment. Mostly people who talk about that nowadays are environmentalists. But I think that what drives environmentalists is actually a feeling for the numinosity of nature, for the sacred importance of nature. And they disguise it as a political movement. That's why I think they get so upset when the land is damaged. I think they experience it as sacrilege, actually. So they have this kind of experience. I was hurrying to class at the university, and because I was late, I had to cross an expanse of lawn. As I ran across the grass, I had the most amazing and horrible experience. I could feel that each blade of grass had a life force. I could feel it, that the ground had a life force, that everything was bound together in this wonderful dance. I could feel my feet crushing the blades of grass, and I could feel the pain the grass felt. This experience came totally unbidden and unexpected, and I realized that I was something more than this pocket of flesh and mind. Okay, so rather than just tell her that nature is alive and that the grass is alive, or the plants and so on are alive, here she actually experienced it. Again, there's this experience of the veil being lifted. I mean, presumably that's this kind of thing is going on all the time, all around us. And then when we have this kind of experience, the veil is suddenly lifted and we're granted a new kind of vision. And once you've had this kind of experience, you probably never experience nature again in the same way. The body, of course, is another very important neglected area that we have to talk about. This is an experience that occurred after a night of lovemaking, described by a young woman. She and her partner had been making love all night, and she said, "Suddenly, I stood outside of time. It was as if time normally flowed in a horizontal plane, and I had somehow stepped out of this horizontal flow into a timeless state. There was no sense of the passage of time. There was simply no time." This is a very transcendent state of mind that she experiences through the body. The body, as you know, has had a bad reputation in the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's been devalued a great deal. Nowadays, I think that the reason that we have so many forms of body therapy and body psychotherapy, that people are beginning to re-experience the actual numinosity of the body. I mean, in its better moments, the tradition has recognized that the body is the temple of the spirit. That has certainly been said, but it's also been devalued and demonized. And I think that as that attitude is fading a little, people are having more and more and more numinous experience in the body. And the interest in yoga and all these body therapies is a reflection of the fact that people are experiencing the numinosum through the body nowadays. I have some more examples, but I think it would be tedious to... I think you've gotten the point. So I'd like to talk about a kind of experience that I think might be a bit controversial. And it has to do with the use of psychedelics. And the argument is whether psychedelics produce, like LSD and psilocybin and so on, whether they produce authentic spiritual experience or not. The people who say that they don't say that these compounds just screw up your brain, they disturb your brain chemistry, and... You're just getting a distorted experience based on the fact that your brain isn't working properly. People who do believe that these are authentic, for example, Houston Smith wrote a book a few years ago, and he uses, I've forgotten the title of it, I think it's called Cleansing the Doors of Perception, or some phrase like that. He uses the phrase entheogens. It's E-N-T-H-E-O-G-E-N-S. And if you break that down etymologically, it means the birth of the divine within. So rather than call them psychedelics, if you believe that these do produce authentic spiritual experience, you can call them an entheogen. You may still get arrested for taking it, but that's another problem. But let me tell you why I'm in the school of thought that thinks that they produce authentic experiences. I've heard several experiences like this. Having taken an entheogen, I suddenly felt myself floating. I seemed to exist as pure consciousness within brilliant light, and I felt blissful peace and joy. I became aware of two beings composed entirely of light. We discussed my path in life and their relevance to my life's purpose. The deep wisdom and compassion of these beings helped me understand and accept several painful life events and feel forgiveness towards people who'd hurt me. I felt relief and emotional healing. They led me to a golden platform that was like a stepped pyramid. At the top was a blaze of brilliant diamond light, radiantly clear, sparkling with flashes of color. I sensed this was a divine presence. The light coalesced into the form of a goddess. No words were exchanged, just unspeakable reverence and devotion on my part and unfathomable love on hers. I knew that she was Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion in the East. She smiled at me and then turned her gaze at what appeared to be the earth far below, surrounded by the darkness of space. As I looked at the planet, I saw countless drops of light, which I knew represented every living being on the earth. My heart opened. I experienced incomparable love for all life and the deepest compassion I have ever known. I felt unconditional love for all, including rapists and murderers, whom I loved with the sadness of one who sees their suffering. I knew them as lost souls who had forgotten their true nature, and I felt a deep desire to help guide each one towards their birthright. Looking at Kuan Yin, I realized that my experience was simply a reflection of her divine nature shared with me at this moment. Now, this is the experience. To someone say that this is the experience of a disordered brain, to me, sounds crazy itself. I mean, it would sound defensive to say that. This is high-level spirituality. This can't be the result of a disordered brain. In my misspent youth, when I used to do psychiatry, I saw a lot of people in toxic confusional states. Most of them didn't remember what they'd experienced, and the ones that did never told me anything like this. This is something else, I think. This woman had been raised in a very abusive household and been very ridiculed by her mother. And Kuan Yin is the archetype of the compassionate divine mother, of the kind she didn't have as a child. So the vision was very helpful. Now, again, depending on your commitment, you could dismiss this as defensive. Or you could, with Jung, you could say this is an example of healing contact with the numinous. I would say that the coherence of the experience and the high level of spirituality in it is evidence that it's authentic, but it's very hard to prove one way or the other. It's really a matter of commitment. All these things are still a matter of commitment. They're not matters of proof. But I always tell students that when you do research, you're allowed one miracle. You've got to prove the rest, but you've got to begin somewhere. And that's the miracle that you're allowed to begin with. If you have to prove the thing you begin with, the axiom that you begin with, that's a whole other piece of research. So my miracle is that I take these things at face value as authentic experiences of the sacred. But I can't prove it, really. I think we're supposed to stop at 9, is that right? I was asked to talk a little bit about relationship. Why the numinosity of relationship? I was reading recently about these new mega churches where 3,000 people might be in the congregation. When I've talked to people who are very keen churchgoers, and I've asked them, "Why do you go to church?" Mostly, they don't give me explanations in terms of esoteric theology. They go from church to church until they find one that they like. And when I ask them why they like it, they don't tell me, well, the theology here is, I prefer it to the theology there, and this doctrine's better than... They say, I like the people more. I get along with the people. It's all about the search for community. And I think what's really numinous for many people who go to church and synagogues nowadays is actually the sense of community, the sense of connection with other people. And they're sitting there and they're singing all these hymns and things, but what they really care about is the connection to other people around them. I think that's where the numinosum is really manifesting itself. And I think that that's what's going on in some of these very large congregations. The people don't care so much about the theology. They care about being with other people. Now, again, there are psychoanalytic explanations for this. If you know Kohut, he has a whole thing on what's called the twinship transference, where we like to be with people who are like us, who believe the same things that we do, who share the same ideals and values and so on. So, you know, anything can be reduced. But I think there's more to it than that. I think, you know, those of us who go to church or synagogue at Easter or the Jewish High Holy Days or Christmas or whatever it is, because we feel like we're supposed to. The most we ever get out of it is a sense of the family or a sense of connection to other people. It really is not the theology or the doctrine or the dogma that's being talked about. It always seems to me it's about the connection. Well, why is that? Well, I think it's because we are all expressions of the same self, the same capital S self. I'll be talking more about this tomorrow when I talk about the non-duality in depth psychology. But Jung is very clear that this self, this image of the divine, that is, if you're an object relations theorist, you could talk about this as an a priori object, an a priori internal object that the baby is born with, that's there, present at birth, not the result of internalization. That upsets a lot of object relations theorists because they have a thing about internalization. But actually, you're born with this already there. That's sort of the Jungian contribution. That's why somebody calls it the 2-million-year-old man, should be person. But there's something already there when the baby is born. There's this self, capital S self, already present. And every human being is an expression of that, is that, actually. Just as, for example, all snowflakes, even though every snowflake looks different, but they're all water. So you can have difference without, you can have distinction without a difference, in a way. That's not a very good metaphor. I can't really find a good metaphor, but I can only kind of gesture at what I'm talking about. Basically, it's the same sense, it's the same self in all of us, or we're all expressions of the same self. Now, sometimes when we get deeply connected with other people, we feel that sense of the self in the other, which it's like the biblical phrase, deep calls to deep. You have a resonant experience with that in the other, which is actually the same as that in yourself. And that's, in a nutshell, is what makes relationships so numinous. That's what you're really connecting with. Now, some people project the self onto other people. We call that idealization. And so we can idealize all kinds of strange people. And when we idealize people, you know, the self-psychologists have discovered this and they call it idealization. And they think it has to do with the need for soothing and all the rest of it. The need for comfort, the need to find somebody who has goals and values that you can follow if you don't have an internal sense of direction. There's a whole psychoanalytic explanation of why we need to idealize somebody and see them as wonderful and larger than life and so on. The real reason is that we're searching for a divinity, and instead of experiencing it in ourselves, we project the self, or we project the experience of the divine onto other people. So idealization of another person, like falling in love, when you first fall in love, is an experience of the divine embodied in the other person. Why it wears off is a whole other problem. but I think it's those kind of dynamics, the experience of the divine in the other, or the resonance of that in oneself and in the other, that makes relationships so numinous. So that's the short answer to your question. Okay. So it's 8:55, so can we just spend 5 minutes with questions? Or? Yes?
Carl, would you comment on, briefly on active imagination?
Comment on it?
Does it meet all the criteria of
Otto? I beg your pardon, I
couldn't
hear you.
Does it meet the criteria of Otto?
Oh, it can do. Yeah, the question was about active imagination and whether it meets Otto's criteria. You can definitely have numinous experiences in active imagination. And you can do it in the body. You know Gendlin's focusing method? I don't know if you're familiar with that. There's a way of doing active imagination in the body. But the short answer is yes, you can definitely have numinous experiences doing active imagination, because they're really waking dreams. So I would say yes. Maybe everyone's stunned into silence. We could stop. Yes.
Okay.
Oh, it's going to be difficult, I can tell.
So I'm assuming that back a ways people had important spiritual visions.
Yeah.
Religions grew up around them.
Yeah.
Then you had a bunch of people who were organized around that religion.
Yeah.
The imagery.
Right.
The numinous experiences.
Right.
With some people and not others.
Right.
There's difficulties. wars,
yeah,
awful things. Now, so now we've got a emerging spiritual practice arising out of
right
psychology.
Right.
What way do you see people having something to do with this in groups?
Oh, in groups, yeah.
The
question is, does this have anything to do with groups? Or maybe community would be a better word.
Have you reflected on the interface of this emerging spiritual practice and the need for community and expression of this?
Yeah. The question is about how is this relevant, am I paraphrasing, how is this relevant to community and how would this express itself in community?
Yeah.
Something like that. I think that the function of a spiritual community should be to help everybody in it find his or her own experience of the sacred. I would suggest, instead of everybody experiencing the sacred, say in the form of Jesus or the Buddha or in some single way, that the community helps every individual find his or her own way. That would be the way, and that we respect each other. See, the last thing we want is all these wars over competing God images, which is obviously absurd. And that's what we have now. We have the experiences of the founders, Muhammad and Jesus and Moses and so on, and then all these different God images and ways of thinking about it are causing wars. Well, we've tried that for 2,000 or more years. That doesn't work. We should try something else. Don't you think it's time? And what we could try is simply saying that there's a debate in the literature about whether what I'm talking about is a via positiva or a via negativa, whether these are saying something about the nature of the divine in a positive way or not. And I would say that because there are so many God images that could manifest themselves, so many ways that the sacred could manifest themselves, that you end up having to appropriate a via negativa. You have to end up saying, none of these are the thing itself. None of these are absolute. None of these would apply to everybody. They're just instances that are useful. And even for the individual, they can change. I could give you a quick example of how they could change if you would like to hear this. A friend of mine told me this experience, and actually I just emailed her this morning and got a note back. And I'm going to put this in my new book, so I have her permission to talk about this publicly. She said she started off her life, she had a very austere, angry father. And so when she started to work on her father material, she had a dream in which she's suspended by a huge hook up in the sky, and an old man with a long white beard and a white robe, who she realizes is God the Father, is down below and fires cannonballs at her, and she's helplessly suspended. Now that is a classic example of how, you know, many people have written about this. Anna Maria Rizzuto and Michael St. Clair and all kinds of people have written about how your experience with your father or mother contaminates your God image. If you have angry, punitive parents, you may subscribe to a theology of an angry God and so on. There's a big literature on that. Or you may react against it and so on. Anyway, after doing a great deal of work on this, this is what Jung calls the transformation of God. He says, as we go more and more into the unconscious, we come across these untransformed God images and then they transform. It's in one of the letters somewhere. Ettinger has a good book about this called The New God Image. I forget the letter, but anyway, it's called The Transformation of God. Anyway, so after years of working on this father problem, which is not uncommon, she has another dream in which she goes into a room, and there's a big room like this, and in this room there are God images from all the traditions, icons and paintings and statues from all the world's religious traditions, and she's told that she can have anyone she wants. And as she walks around the room, she's drawn to this laughing Buddha. Okay, you remember this, I think, 9th century Zen priest. I think his name was Hotei or Potei, depending if it's Japanese or Chinese. And he's enormously fat, and he's got a bag of goodies that he gives to children. He's got a big smile on his face. I'm not sure if it was 9th century or not, but somewhere around there. And it's an expression of the joy of spiritual practice and the joy, you know, the joy that can be found in an authentic spirituality. And this figure in the dream is wearing a golden crown. And she realizes that's the one she wants. Okay? So look at the difference between this punitive, angry, sort of baroque god image of the old man with the beard and this joyful, and that's what Jung means by the transformation of God. And that's the kind of transformation that can occur as you work on your own material. You can at the same time transform your images of the sacred, or you don't transform them. They spontaneously change as you withdraw the original parental projections and you start to experience the sacred in different ways. But you can't do that until you've freed up your inner world. That's why you have to do your own psychological work on your complexes before this stuff starts to change. Because remember, at the center of the complex, if the archetype is at the center of the complex, there's an element of the sacred right in the middle of your pathology. That's why Jung is able to say that your pathology is an expression of the sacred, which sounds like a weird thing to say if you think that the divine is only light. But if you realize that the archetype can be at the center of these very painful complexes, then it can manifest itself in a negative way. But the good news is that it can transform. So we have a different kind of good news now. I think I'd like to stop. My voice is practically gone. Okay, thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.